CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
Today on Face the Nation, the Republican Party becomes the party of Trump, and the tent goes up on the general election circus. With the nomination locked up, Donald Trump went to Washington this week to make peace with the Republicans he's campaigned against. But by Friday, Trump was bombarded with blasts from the past. He denied reports that he's posed as his own spokesman in the 1990s. And his refusal to release his tax returns gave Hillary Clinton a new line of attack.
My husband and I have released 33 years of tax returns.
We'll talk about efforts to unify the party with the head of the Republican National Committee, Reince Priebus, and three House Republicans. And what should we look for in a president? We'll ask former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who served eight of them. It's all ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. Chairman of the Republican National Committee, Reince Priebus, joins us now. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask you about a report that Donald Trump in the 1990s served as his own spokesman under another name. What do you make of that?
It's a little bit odd, but I will just tell you that I think of all the things facing this country right now, and after being through this primary for a year, I can assure you that particular issue is not going to move the electorate. I mean, people are comparing Hillary Clinton, a career politician, someone who's made millions of dollars on politics, and a guy who's never run for public office, a business guy, who's a total outsider that's going to cause an earthquake in Washington. That's really the issue that's on the ballot. All these other stories, and there's going to be, I'm sure, lots of stories. My guess is it's not going to move the electorate. That's not what they're looking at.
Well, now that we are looking at a general electorate, and as you point out, he's a total outsider, yeah. Very new. But isn't that the point? Is since he's unknown, these kinds of stories are ones that people key on. And I guess in this case, it's not so much the impersonation, but that this week he denied it, though in the past he said he had. On the Today Show, he said it wasn't him, but in the past, he said it was.
I mean, I think the issues that are facing Washington are, you know, who's going to bring a more efficient, accountable, effective government here? And I don't think the electorate's going to look at whether or not someone was calling a reporter 30 years ago and it was them or it wasn't them as the issue that they're deciding in this campaign. Donald Trump has effectively carved out a niche for himself, which is, I'm the guy that's going to turn this place upside down. People believe that. They don't believe that Hillary Clinton is that person. And by the way, Hillary, we have to be careful who throws stones in glass houses, because Hillary Clinton can't throw any. So she's not going anywhere in that regard. So it's going to come down to that issue. Who's going to be the change agent? It's not going to be Hillary Clinton.
One of the ways we, in the past, have evaluated new candidates on the scene is looked at their tax returns. Donald Trump said that he doesn't think people have a right to see his tax returns. In the past, that was kind of the standard. Do you think that shouldn't be the standard anymore, whether we should look at a candidate's past tax returns?
I wouldn't be surprised if people don't care. I mean, I think one thing for sure, Donald Trump has rewritten the traditional playbook in politics. And I don't know if anyone else could have pulled off what he's pulled off over the past year, but just sort of traditional review and analysis of individual candidates has not applied to Donald Trump. And I think it's because he's presented himself as something bigger than just the traditional analysis. And people are angry. People want something done right this second. And Donald Trump has effectively represented that position. Now, whether or not his taxes are disclosed or not is something I don't think is going to move the electorate.
I guess the question is whether political success changes the standard by which we evaluate a candidate. When Bill Clinton was successful in politics, a lot of Republicans said, you know, that shouldn't change the standard. He should still be judged on the old-fashioned standard. Don't let his political success create a kind of relativism that changes our standards.
Well, I mean, it's a good point. But, you know, look at Bill Clinton. He served for 8 years and he's still out there running around and people are still coming and cheering him on. I think that the real analysis has to be, at least from my standpoint in the moment, what it is exactly we have to do as a party to make sure that, number one, we have, you know, we're true to our party, we're true to our platform, and that the party exists as it is today in the future, and the fact that we want to win in November, and Donald Trump is someone who has been winning more votes in the primary than any Republican nominee in the history of our primaries.
Yeah.
And so I look at what the voters are saying, John, and the voters are saying, I like what I'm hearing.
There's talk of a third party. Bill Kristol and Mitt Romney are trying to put one together. Should they stop that?
Well, I've heard that Mitt actually isn't looking at that. I'm not sure about Bill Kristol, but it's a suicide mission because you're not only changing and throwing out 8 years of the White House, but you're also throwing out potentially generations on the Supreme Court. Look, we could have up to three justices change over in the next 8 years. And this is a suicide mission. It is not right. And I think what people should do is take the Paul Ryan approach, which is to work with Donald Trump and find out whether or not there's common ground and whether there can be assurances on the Supreme Court and those sorts of things to make sure that our future is secure down the line as opposed to blowing everything up.
Let me ask you about Paul Ryan. He differs with Mr. Trump on the issues of immigration, entitlements, taxes, trade. Three times during the campaign, he came out and questioned his tone on issues from the Muslim ban on immigration to his reluctance to denounce white supremacists. So what's the basis for unity between the two of them?
Well, look, I think they agree on far more than they disagree on. I mean, they agree on various agenda items in Paul Ryan's agenda. They agree on the Supreme Court. They agree on the platform of the Republican Party. They agree on abortion. I mean, look, I think you've got about 80% overlap, and you've seen actually Donald Trump this week nuance a little bit on some of those positions that you've just outlined. And so I think we're going to get there. I think there's plenty of common ground. And when the choice is Hillary Clinton, when someone who's made a career of lying and skirting the issues, And you'd look at the emails, the Benghazi, the Clinton Foundation, and a guy who's never run for office and might have some stories out there that you know make some interesting news. I think in the end, people are going to choose the person that's going to cause an earthquake in Washington and get something done over Hillary Clinton.
All right, Chairman Reince Priebus, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet, John.
For more on the relationship between the Republican Party and Donald Trump, we're joined by three Republican members of Congress. Representative Marsha Blackburn is in Nashville this morning. Peter King is on Long Island.
Yeah.
And the first House member to support Donald Trump, Chris Collins of New York, joins us here in Washington.
Yeah, good to be with you, John.
Representative Collins, I want to ask you, what is it specifically about Donald Trump, other than that he's not Hillary Clinton, that specifically about Donald Trump that Republicans should unify around?
Well, first of all, he's a chief executive. He's not a career politician. And we need someone coming out of the private sector, certainly someone who has been a chief executive. We've seen what happened with a legislator, Barack Obama, the imperial presidency the last 7.5 years. And the reason I threw my weight behind and my support behind Donald Trump 11 weeks ago, when it was Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Donald Trump, he was the only chief executive. And I feel like that's a very important attribute with everything this nation is facing. So that's what drove me there, coupled with his issues on trade. We've been in a trade war for 20 years. It's going to continue. The other countries are going to try to continue to steal our jobs as Mexico and China has. And we've got to have a president who's going to stand up, bring those jobs back, and let's start talking about fair and balanced trade, not this free trade nonsense like NAFTA.
Representative King, Congressman makes a good point about executive experience and the executive role of the president. There's nowhere that's more important than on national security decisions. The president makes a call. Sometimes Congress doesn't even get a say. That was the area where you had the most criticism and skepticism about Donald Trump. So on national security, where it's so important, what made you come to support him?
Well, I'm supporting him as the nominee of the party, but I still have real questions with him as far as national security. I don't think his Asian policy is coherent because, again, if he does want to get in a trade war with China, he has to explain how that coincides with him wanting to use China against North Korea. If he wants to have leverage over China, how can he be talking about taking troops out of Japan or Korea? Does he know that it costs more to take the troops out than to leave them there? And does he realize that that would just weaken our leverage against China? I'm very concerned about this romance he seems to have with Putin. And as far as his statement that he wants Russia to take care of what's happening in Syria, that's Barack Obama's policy. But again, I there's a lot about Donald Trump I like. He's brought people into the Republican Party. He's brought in the blue-collar Reagan Democrats, which we had lost over the years. So there's a real chance here. But on the foreign policy, I want him to make his policy more coherent. I'm endorsing him. I'm going to vote for him. But before I can actively campaign, I have to see a much more coherent foreign policy.
Representative Blackburn, in picking up on that, the idea that Donald Trump is going to change from some of the things he said before, Chairman Priebus said that he's already nuancing, or that was his word, some of his positions. That once used to, in Republican politics, be a dirty word, using nuance. You wanted people who stood on their principles. What's your view of Donald Trump and where he was in the primary and how he might change in the general election?
I think what you're beginning to see is Donald Trump has listened to the American people, and he has shown that he has heard them. They like the way he has listened and responded, and he's bringing that information to Capitol Hill. And I quite frankly am encouraged that he's trying to find common ground and to say to us, what legislation do you have out there that you've been working on that we can move forward together? I think that's a wonderful opportunity for us, and it's an opportunity for the American people. You're probably going to see a very aggressive legislative agenda. I look forward to a first 100 days of the President Trump administration when we can roll back some of this regulation that people complain about every day, when we can take the hold, the stranglehold off of some of our small businesses and allow them to move forward and push forward with innovation and job creation, which is certainly what they're wanting to see. Job stagnation, wage stagnation, yeah, is just driving people crazy.
Let me ask you, Congressman Collins, about some other positions that Donald Trump mentioned in the primary. The immediate deportation of those who are here illegally, the ban on Muslim immigration. Are those policies you support?
No, John, those aren't policies I support. But as we've seen with Mr. Trump, the one thing, coming back to one of the other answers, what's never changed with Donald Trump is he's going to secure the borders, bring our jobs back, get the economy growing, and keep our nation safe and defeat ISIS. That's something he's been talking about for a year, and that's not going to change. He is reaching out to Congress. He's reaching out to our committee chair. Half of our committee chairmen have now endorsed Mr. Trump, and he's asking for their input on tax reform. He's asking their input on transportation and infrastructure. That's what a chief executive does, sets the top-line vision, hires a great cabinet, brings in the experts, they argue it out across a table, around a table, and then they come to decisions. You're just now seeing Donald Trump, the nominee, moving into the policy area. So as he ran for the nomination, that's not to say that he did anything other than the 30,000-foot level. So I don't think it's that he's nuancing it. He's just now putting his team together. Mm-hmm.
Representative King, I want to ask you a political question now, which is about women voters. Do you think that Donald Trump has an issue that he has to fix with women voters?
I think the issue was there, but again, I don't know if Hillary Clinton is the person to raise it. And also, I mean, listen, Donald Trump is a very good spokesman. He's going to go out there and, you know, make his case on this. And if there are any particular issues with women, I'm sure he'll answer them. But overall, I think, listen, the average woman, if there's such a thing as average man or an average woman, all Americans, but maybe particularly women, they're concerned about security. I was talking to a woman yesterday who's been active in Republican politics for years. And her view was whether or not she likes or dislikes Donald Trump, she's concerned about her kids staying alive. She's concerned about security. She lives in New York. She saw 9/11, and she never wants to see that repeated again. And that's why she does believe that Donald Trump is a guy who will have the guts to stand up and do what has to be done. I just want him to fill in the details. But I think if he can show women and men, especially suburban mothers, that he is going to defend us, if he's going to keep us strong, then that's what they are most concerned about, the economy, jobs, but also security, so the kids are not killed by terrorists.
Representative Blackburn, I want to ask you about Paul Ryan. The previous speaker was getting a lot of grief for not standing up and sticking to principle. Paul Ryan says he has issues with Donald Trump at the moment, doesn't want to come to a unified position yet. Shouldn't he be praised for that, for standing on principle?
I think you're going to see Paul Ryan move very, very quickly toward working with Donald Trump and unifying the Republican Party. And quite frankly, John, I think we're going to have the most dynamic campaign this fall that we have had in decades. You have millions of new voters that have come to the Republican Party. You have people who are saying, let's build a bigger tent. Let's bring people in. Let's address these problems. As Peter said, national security. Chris said, jobs and economic security, and I'll add a third one, retirement security. Those are the three top issues that we are hearing about. It doesn't matter if it's male or female. What they know is Hillary Clinton is a lying, cheating, stealing type woman, and what they've got in Donald Trump is a can-do man who says, we're going to get in behind and fix it. Don't know exactly how, but let's be a great team and let's get it done. That's what they want.
All right, we're going to have to end it there. Thanks to all of you. Earlier, we traveled to William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, to talk to Robert Gates, who is chancellor at the school. We began by asking him for his thoughts on Donald Trump.
Well, I have some real issues with things he said about national security policy and some concerns. I think there are some contradictions. You can't have a trade war with China and then turn around and ask them to help you on North Korea. I have no idea what his policy would be in terms of dealing with ISIS. I worry a little bit about his admiration for Vladimir Putin.
You've served eight presidents. Are these the kinds of reservations that can be, are these policy position issues, or can they be fixed with a good staff?
They're policy positions, so they can always change. I mean, I've seen presidents do that more than once. I guess one of the things that makes it challenging for me is that he seems to think that he has all the answers and that he doesn't need any advice from staff or anybody else, and that he knows more about these things than anybody else and doesn't really feel the need to surround himself with informed advisors. You know, I worked for some very different presidents of those eight. You know, people would say, how could you work for both Barack Obama and George W. Bush? And I remind them, well, I worked for Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. The difference is each one of those presidents, as strong-minded as each of them was, understood he did not have all the answers and surrounded himself with experienced, thoughtful people who would give good advice, and they were willing to listen. They would often make their own independent judgments. They often would act contrary to the advice they were receiving. But nonetheless, they only acted after they had listened to different points of view and then had the opportunity to make up their mind.
Is that a fatal flaw?
I think that one would have to show between now and the election, it seems to me, that you were willing to do that. And willing to listen to people, willing to adjust your positions, to give any sense of confidence that, you know, I come into this, all this, from the national security standpoint. And that's what I look at. I came to this interview from commissioning 18 brand new second lieutenants coming out of ROTC. And I think about all those young people in the military and who's going to be in charge of them. Who's going to be in a position to give them orders? And so I want to see some evidence that a person can be trusted with the lives of those young people.
Would you serve him if he asked?
Well, I learned a long time ago never to say never, but let's just say it, that would be inconceivable to me. I, before the election, I will be 73, and let's just say I've stopped working on my resume.
But let's say you were a young buck of 63. Would you would it be an administration you could see yourself serving?
Well, I think there would have to be a conversation with the candidate to see. You know, when President-elect Obama asked me to stay on, we did something very unusual. We had this secret meeting in the firehouse at Reagan Airport in Washington. And I had sent him 10 questions, you know, and beginning with, why do you think you can trust me? And what are your positions on Afghanistan and the defense budget? And who's the rest of the team going to be? No matter what age I might be, those were the questions. Those are questions that I think would have to be asked.
We'll have a lot more of our conversation with Secretary Gates later in the broadcast.
No, it's true. I'm telling you. Mr. Trump is the real-life inspiration for Iron Man. Who am I? I'm his publicist, Joey Pepperoni. No, I'm not Donald Trump in disguise. This is just what classy people sound like, okay?
And that's not Donald Trump or even John Miller or Joey Pepperoni. That's Daryl Hammond from last night's Saturday Night Live. Joining us now to talk about what's been quite a week on the political front is USA Today's Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page, Slate's Chief Political Correspondent and CBS News Political Analyst Jamelle Bouie, White House Correspondent for the Associated Press Julie Pace, and Washington Post columnist Michael Gerson. Susan, I want to start with you. Is Chairman Priebus right that this question of impersonating a spokesperson, it's the first little bump in the general election, but is Chairman Priebus right that this is just going to go by the wayside?
You know, I think the reality that he was impersonating someone else, himself, as producing himself as his own PR person, is not really, 25 years ago, is not important. The fact that he is now denying it, when it, on the face of it, it just seems to be true, is perhaps an issue, not for the people who support him. I think it's been clear through these primaries that people who support him are going to support him no matter what. But in his effort to expand the electorate that supports him in a general election, I think it's probably one of those things that makes people think, who is this man? Can I trust him? Can I trust him to be president and commander-in-chief? Not a big deal, but maybe part of a case that could be made against him by his opponents.
Michael, what do you make of Chairman Priebus essentially saying, boy, the voters really like Donald Trump, and so that's proof that these questions about him, whether it's taxes or any of this other stuff, don't really matter.
A one-step-away defense. He's not actually defending his views. He's saying what an extraordinary phenomenon this guy is. That's an odd position for the chairman of the RNC to be in. I mean, this is a case where he's deceiving people, I think. But he has never had a cost to that. So it's encouraged him over time. He gets away with it, and that encourages it.
Jamelle, what do you think of the Clinton campaign has tried to make a lot of the tax returns that Donald Trump has not released? Is that profitable for her, given the fact that she set up her own email server outside the rules? The FBI is looking into whether there was any criminal activity associated with that. Does she really want to have a big, frank conversation about transparency?
Right. I don't think she does. I think the Clinton campaign is approaching Donald Trump so far as if he were a normal and typical nominee from the other side. And I think it's just the wrong approach for the Clinton campaign to take. If some of the rhetoric coming from the Clinton campaign is true, that Trump is something unprecedented, then these avenues of attack are really not helpful. Because Trump's argument is that, listen, I'm a sleazy guy. I'm not going to deny that. I'm sleazy. I'm probably a little dishonest. But what you need in the White House is someone who is sleazy and dishonest for you. And so I think Clinton has to find a way to say, listen, he's sleazy and dishonest, but it's never going to be for you. And he is sort of conjuring the worst impulses Americans have for no other reason than his own personal gain. And that's going after him on tax returns and, you know, transparency just doesn't do that. Elizabeth Warren seems to figure out how to do it. And I think the Clinton campaign needs to sort of huddle with her about making those kinds of attacks.
All right. We're going to pause there. We're going to step away for a commercial, but we'll have a great deal more with our panel covering all the week's news. And stick with us.
Hello, I'm Jerry Mathers. I was the Beaver in Leave It to Beaver. And 20 years ago, I almost died from type 2 diabetes. When I was diagnosed with type 2, I was shocked. My blood sugar was through the roof. Now, the very same natural remedies I use to control my type 2 diabetes are available for you in a super easy program called the Diabetes Solution Kit. And I should know it works. I use the very same techniques to drop 40 pounds of fat, get my blood sugar under control, and watch my type 2 diabetes fade into thin air. If you have diabetes, I urge you to try this step-by-step plan. It has all the natural techniques I used, and it works a lot faster, too. I'm Jerry Mathers, and if I can do it, you can do it, too.
If you'd like to normalize your blood sugar and stop taking your diabetes medication completely with your doctor's approval, go to diabetic44.com. That's diabetic44.com. Reverse your diabetes in as little as 30 days by going to diabetic44.com. That's diabetic44.com now.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. We're back with Susan Page of USA Today, Jamelle Bouie from Slate, Julie Pace from the Associated Press, and Washington Post's Michael Gerson. Julie, I want to start with you. This was the week that Donald Trump met with Paul Ryan. Where do things stand in the Republican Unity Project at the end of this week?
Well, we heard a lot of talk about unity. That was sort of the word of the week. At this point, it seems to be a bit of superficial unity because beneath the surface, there continue to be huge differences between the Paul Ryan wing of the Republican Party and what now is the Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party. But I think the fact that Trump came to Washington, had this closed-door meeting with Ryan, and got the speaker to come out and speak quite warmly about him was actually an accomplishment. And I think it showed that there is an effort underway on Capitol Hill to have lawmakers unify around Trump. And even a week ago, that was a big open question. I think we now see the direction that this is headed.
Michael, give me your take on this in terms of what the party is going through. Is this a situation where all parties, you know, it's a little messy getting unified. People say some things during the primaries, but then they all come together and row in the same direction. Is that what we have here, or?
Well, I think that Ryan has laid the predicate for eventual surrender on this. I think that's the case. And I think that Trump is benefiting from extreme polarization in America. So a lot of people that thought that they were never Trump are very much never Hillary Clinton in the party. And they're making a short-term appeal on the Supreme Court. That all makes sense. But there's a long-term problem with having Trump as your nominee. I mean, Republicans have problems with immigrants, and he is proposing to get rid of 11 million people. They've got problem with women. And you look at the New York Times front page story, you know, this is a whole second front in the war on women that he represents. I think that there's a short-term calculation, but then huge long-term risks for the Republican Party to confirm some of its worst, most destructive stereotypes. And that could take decades to get beyond.
Which is what you see Paul Ryan struggling with, I think, because in the short term, it you can't imagine the Republican Speaker of the House is not going to endorse the Republican candidate for president. I don't think that's a realistic scenario. But you see him struggling with trying to see if maybe he can pull Trump back a little bit, or maybe on some of his rhetoric, or do something, can
but he
moderate
didn't get
him
anything
in
return
because,
that I could tell.
Right.
There
well,
was not,
Paul
no,
Ryan
there's no
trade.
You know, there's no template for getting anything from Trump, right? Nobody who's opposed Trump in the past has gotten anything from Trump. But Paul Ryan is 46 years old. He's going to be around when Donald Trump is gone. And I think he's trying to figure out, what can I do that protects the Republican Party that I want to represent? Because I don't think Donald Trump is now a wing of the Republican Party. Donald Trump is the face of the Republican Party this year. Donald Trump defines the GOP, at least until November.
So I think not rejecting Donald Trump kind of sets up this future Paul Ryan for kind of the same kind of failure. Because part of the problem, part of the reason Donald Trump could even win in the Republican primary is that the countervailing forces that could have existed, a large share of Latino Republicans or a large share of African-American Republicans, just don't exist. You mentioned polarization, Michael. I think there's much racial polarization in American politics than anything else that's produced Trump. And Trump himself is going to kind of reinforce that racial polarization. You know, after 64, Goldwater essentially helped make African-Americans a permanent Democratic voting group. Trump can do the same for Latinos, right? And so 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you could have an entirely new generation of Hispanic voters who are still voting for Democrats because of Trump.
Julie, how long does Paul Ryan have? He says he doesn't want fake unity, but at some point, doesn't he have to get to yes for a variety of reasons? But how long do you think that is?
Well, he says this is going to be a long process. To Michael's point, I think that he will want something. I don't know what that will be, because there is so much difference between these two men in terms of style, in terms of tone, in terms of their vision for the party long term. I think that he clearly sent the message that he is going to get there. And for him personally, the longer this takes, all this means is that every day that Paul Ryan is on Capitol Hill, he's going to be asked, are you there yet? Have you decided to endorse him? And it's going to overshadow what he really believes in strongly, which is a positive, affirmative agenda for that Republicans can run on in the fall. So he has to balance that. that? How much does he want this open question about Trump to overtake what he believes is an agenda that his House members can run on in November?
Michael, you've seen a president up close, what they look like, having worked for one. I was interested in Congressman King saying, well, if Donald Trump changes some positions on North Korea, on some other specific areas, he would feel more confident. Is that really all that this is about, is just getting the right positions on these issues?
I think politicians are used to dealing with splitting differences on issues. They're used to the best of, you know, two bad alternatives. But the question is here whether the Republican candidate for president is fit to be president, whether he has pursued a division and nativism at the center of American politics that could really change our public life in destructive ways, fundamental and destructive ways. And under those circumstances, you're not talking about this issue or that issue. You're talking about fitness. You're talking about, can this man represent America in the world? Can he represent all our citizens in this process? And those are open questions right now, given the way that he has gotten to this point.
Jamal, what Ryan Priebus and others would say is that, well, whatever questions people may have about Donald Trump and his fitness for the office, Hillary Clinton has, and we heard him say it today,
yeah,
has the same kinds of challenges. Is that a pretty good pushback to the point Michael makes?
I don't think it's a good pushback at all. You know, Hillary Clinton has a whole host of problems. She has, you know, aforementioned problems in transparency. She has her tight connections to Wall Street. She has all these things that people on the left or right are justly upset about. But she is fundamentally a mainstream politician. She exists well within the categories of American politics. On policy substance, she's not that far from Barack Obama. Trump is, I use this word intentionally, he's conjuring sort of the worst kind of nativism. He's conjuring bigotry for the sake of trying to win an election. Once you take those, once you open that box in any kind of society, but especially American society, where we have these deep-seated racial divisions that have long had implications for our politics, once you kind of open that box, it doesn't close again. And I think because of that, because Trump is bringing to the fore for the first time in decades, in an explicit way, at least, some of the ugliest impulses in American life. I don't think it's just a matter of, oh, well, you know, Hillary Clinton's worse. I mean, sure, she's a liberal and you don't like her, but she's not encouraging violence at political events.
Right. Well, this gets to the whole calculus that Clinton is making in the general election, which is that voters in the end will want a mainstream politician, someone who does have experience in the political arena. Trump is clearly making a different calculation. He won out on that argument in the Republican primary. And I do think that it's risky for her in some degree, because she does have to try to inspire people. She does have to make them feel like she could come to Washington and shake things up, because in both parties, people want that. She just wants them in the end to come to this idea that you might not like her. You may think she has trouble with honesty, transparency, but she is at least fit for office.
But this is exactly the wrong campaign for Hillary Clinton to be running in, right? She may end up winning, but it's an electorate that wants change. She represents continuity. you know, she wants to outline policy positions, everything. Julie and I were talking about this. She's come out with some very interesting policies in the last couple of weeks, including Medicare for More. Absolutely not breaking through, because what breaks through is what Donald Trump says and how she responds to it. And that will be a dilemma for the next 6 months. How do you define a campaign on your own turf when he is driving the conversation?
I want to pick up on that when we come back. But for the moment, we'll take a little bit of a break. We'll be back with our panel and much more. And we're back now with more from our panel. Michael, I want to try and get you to help me explain, think about what the turf looks like now that we're in a general election. There were a lot of things that were undone by Donald Trump, masterfully, really, in the primaries, in terms of just changing the playbook, as Ryan Priebus called it, of politics. So how much is the playbook totally new now in the general election, or are there some standards that still apply?
Well, he's making an unusual message to the American people. This is not, he's pretty random on his policy views. It's very hard to determine them. It's kind of like quantum physics. They change all the time, okay?
Schrodinger's Trump.
He's offering himself to be in charge of everything, essentially. It's a very much a personal appeal he's making. The side effect of that, by the way, is that we're very likely to get a negative election here. You're going to have two personalities against one another, not necessarily two visions. I think, you know, given Trump's penchant for attacking back with even greater intensity, this could be a very negative election based on personality rather than, on policy views, which he changes all the time.
That's right. And, Julia, it feels like we're going to have, it's not only based on personality, but both parties feel like they're having an arranged marriage here, where we talked about the unity in the Republican Party that's a little difficult getting that put together. But in the Democratic Party, when that contest is over, there's also going to be this kind of arranged marriage.
And it's being put off longer and longer as Bernie Sanders continues to win in several states. He will probably have more victories coming up. You do see Hillary Clinton trying to reach out to Sanders voters. I think what her campaign and what Democrats broadly believe is that having Trump as the Republican nominee will be more of a motivating factor for these Sanders supporters than anything else. But at a certain point, she does have to be able to turn her attention toward the general, toward uniting her party. And the longer that Sanders keeps winning, the harder that becomes for her.
It's very hard to say, why won't you get out of the race? You keep winning.
Right? Yeah. Right. She didn't like when people made that argument against her in 2008, yeah. Certainly.
When you look at the West Virginia primary, which of course Sanders won, the scariest number for the Clinton people were 38% of Sanders voters said they would vote for Trump. Now, West Virginia has some peculiar politics, but that shows the kind of appeal of the anti-establishment candidate that both Sanders and Trump have been.
What if that's right, Jamel? What if it's just, we are so fed up with Washington that, and Ryan Spreeus used the word earthquake, that they want the earthquake. And forget positions, schmissions. We want the earthquake, and that's Donald Trump.
I think that might be true in the Republican Party. I'm just not sure how true it is in the Democratic Party. You ask Sanders voters, separate and apart from the West Virginia primary, you ask them, what do you think of President Obama? Huge approval. You ask them, what do you think of Hillary Clinton? Pretty good approval. You ask them, what kind of policy would you like to see continued? And it's usually kind of an Obama-style mix. So I think much, as was true in 2008, the heat of a primary has sort of created the perception in the Democratic Party that there are these steep divisions. And no doubt, I think there are generational divisions in the Democratic Party that Sanders has revealed and may play themselves out in various ways going forward. But in terms of the presidential race, I tend to think that there really isn't that much disunity in the Democratic Party, and that if Sanders decides to campaign vociferously for the Democratic Party, which, he continuously says, him and his surrogates, that they will do everything they can to keep Donald Trump out of the White House. I don't think this will be such a problem. And I don't think, given that the Democratic Party is almost like, it's close to majority non-white, I just do not think that Trump is the earthquake that anyone in the Democratic Party is looking for.
Michael, let me ask you about the Trump cabinet, which is, in talking to some Republicans, they've said, well, if he puts Chris Christie in here and Ben Carson in there and maybe brings in Giuliani, they take comfort in the people he might surround himself with. Is that a plausible? Is that a good way for him to make the case to a larger group of Republicans? Hey, I'm not. Give them stability.
I think the way to make the case to a larger group of Republicans is to look like you might win. I think that's what persuades a lot of people that are interested in power in Washington, and then all of a sudden they find ways to accommodate in these circumstances. I think, though, that the foreign policy establishment of the Republican Party is probably the least attached to the Republican Party. They've been the most critical of his views, say, on tariffs with China and our ties with our allies, just basic things, which you saw some in the Gates interview as well. These are radical, dangerous foreign policy positions that he's undertaken. I think the foreign policy establishment, has a lot to swallow in order to participate in a Trump administration.
Robert Gates, pretty good Republican, right? Who do you think he's going to vote for? From listening to that interview, he didn't answer that question, but it sure sounded like he was more comfortable with Hillary Clinton than with Donald Trump.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to our panel. We'll be back in a moment with that interview with Secretary Gates. Stay with us.
Listen to the news right now in your car with the CBS Radio News app. Just download our free app to your iOS or Android device to stream the news you need on Apple CarPlay or Android Auto. Listen to the latest news right now or to your favorites like Face the Nation and the Weekend Roundup. The CBS Radio News app. Download it on your phone now to use in Apple CarPlay and Android Auto today.
And we're back with more of our conversation with former Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
You talked about how important it is to have somebody on your staff who tells you no as a president. There has been in the New York Times Magazine, there was a profile of Ben Rhodes, the deputy national security advisor. There's a lot of talk about that in Washington. Is his relationship with Barack Obama typical in your experience?
Well, I think every president has advisors with whom they have a very special relationship. In And particularly, though, when it comes to substantive matters, those advisors tend to be very senior and very experienced. For example, there was an extraordinarily close relationship between the first President Bush and his national security advisor, Brent Scowcroft. I think I had a very close relationship with Bush 41 as deputy national security advisor, sort of the same level position that, that Mr. Rhodes has. So I think that all presidents have those relationships with people that they can trust and people they can be themselves around, people they can let their hair down, say what they really think about somebody. The question is how much influence they have on the policymaking process and whether at the same time they're listening to the senior cabinet officers and others that they've appointed, presumably in whose judgment they also trust.
There has been criticism of the Obama administration that they block or shape or try to shape the views of senior cabinet officials, and there's too much control by the NSC. Did you experience that in your days?
No, I never had that problem, mainly because I just didn't let them. And it's mainly staff. The president always, I found President Obama very welcoming of honest and candid points of view. He and I would have some very direct conversations in private, and he more often than not would end them. And sometimes we disagreed very strongly, and he would end them by standing up, smiling, and saying, "Are you sure I can't get you to stay another year?" So I think...
was he being facetious, or did he like the back and forth?
No, I think he welcomed it. I think he found it of value. He obviously didn't decide my way all the time by any means, but I'm not sure how many people there are left in the administration at this point who are willing to have direct issues with him like that. I just don't know.
One of the conclusions some have drawn in reading that article about the Deputy National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes, is that he shaped the environment for the Iran deal, that he misled the public. Did you see that from your observation of the Iran deal and it's being sold by the White House?
Well, I didn't have that sense. I thought some of the things the White House was saying in terms of believing that lifting the sanctions could over time lead the regime in Iran to change its stripes and become a normal country, if you will, I always thought that was a stretch. But I didn't have the sense that people were being manipulated. That was news to me from that article.
In that article, you are a part of what Rhodes calls the blob of the American foreign policy establishment. What does that mean to you?
The thing that struck me, and because there was also this kind of disdainful reference to the foreign policy establishment in an earlier interview that the president gave. And what intrigued me about it is the notion that the blob all has one point of view. I mean, the blob presumably includes Brent Scowcroft, who was deeply opposed to the Iraq war. It presumably includes me. I was deeply opposed to the intervention in Libya. It presumably includes George Shultz, who's argued for getting rid of nuclear weapons, along with Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense. So the blob is as diverse in its points of view as any group of people around. The one thing the members of that elite group have in common is experience. And some of them have given bad advice. Some of us have given bad advice in the past. Some of us have given pretty good advice. But to lump everybody together and say, and really the candidates kind of do that, and to say, I don't need those people, I don't want those people, is to dismiss an awful lot of experience and a very great diversity of views on the challenges we face and how to deal with them.
The president's characterization of that establishment was that the reaction to any event anywhere else is always kind of the president has to act and act militarily.
Well, and the irony in that is I oppose the intervention in Libya. I mean, my reaction in the Situation Room was during those debates, can I just finish the two wars we're already in before you go looking for a third one? So again, I think that there is this sort of political shorthand of lumping people together that really doesn't make any sense and frankly is a disservice.
The president in that Atlantic article also said that he was proud of his decision not to take military action against Syria, the so-called red line moment.
other people have a different view. Is that something the president should be proud of, his decision not to act?
I would separate that into two questions. Should he have laid down the red line in the first place, and having laid down a red line, or whether or not he laid down a red line, should he have taken military action? First of all, I believe that, and always cautioned, that presidents should be extraordinarily careful about issuing ultimatums or drawing red lines, because when the President of the United States does that, the rest of the world must know it is fatal to cross it. That when the United States makes a threat, it is not an empty threat. That said, so I don't think he should have ever made the threat in the first place, and I would have counseled him against it. Whether he should have used air power early on to either create safe havens or to ground Assad's air force, I think that's a debatable point. Should we send significant numbers of American combat forces into Syria? I would say absolutely not, and I agreed with him on that point.
How different do you think Hillary Clinton's worldview is than Barack Obama's?
Well, you know, they're as to the extent that I've watched the debates and the commentary and so on, I haven't, frankly, seen a lot of discussion about foreign policy on the Democratic side. It was my experience in working with her that she was very tough-minded. And, for example, when General McChrystal was asking for 40,000 additional troops in Afghanistan, she was very tough in support of what the general wanted. She also was an advocate for going into Libya. So I suspect, although we have not had a conversation since I left in almost 5 years, I would suspect that, generally speaking, she is more hawkish than President Obama.
Do you think with Hillary Clinton that politics gets in the way of her judgment?
I did not. All I can say is that in the 2.5 years that we worked together, I never saw that.
You mentioned in your book, in Duty, though, you mentioned that she said that her opposition to the surge during George W. Bush's administration was political.
Well, senators have the luxury of taking positions because they have no responsibility. And and as I've said, I think that I was startled by that, but I never saw her take that position in the 2.5 years. I never saw her in that 2.5 years let domestic politics influence her recommendations to the president or her positions in the Situation Room.
You think she can handle the job of the president?
Yeah, again, I think it also depends in her case. Who is she going to surround herself with? What are the policy options she's going to pursue? What would be her alternatives in places like Syria and with ISIS and how to deal with Putin and the Chinese and so on? And we just haven't heard much of that.
Secretary Gates, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
And we wanted to note that Ben Rhodes is the brother of CBS News President David Rhodes. That's it for us today. Thanks for watching. Until next week, for Face the Nation, I'm John Dickerson. Today's guests were RNC Chairman Reince Priebus, Republican Representatives Marsha Blackburn, Chris Collins, and Peter King, plus former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsnick. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern, every Sunday.